get it wrong.
Yeah.
Right on, we can then begin.
Hello, so on your question about our rezoning proposal that relates to Emmersfield, as long as we discussed, there is the ability for any decisions that arise or any findings that arise out of the rezoning hearing the provision as a whole, as long as there is a process that if they need to be integrated into Chapter 22 and if there needs to be consequential amendments to Chapter 22 provision so that there's a nice fit.
So that would go without saying.
As long as there's that process, then we're very happy to present the rezoning case on both the provisions and what the maps look like as a package next year.
What I'm hoping is that, having given that interim guidance, we might get some better definition of how things fit in with the people proposing changes rather than ad hoc. What's happened in the property plan, this thing dropped in it all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's helpful. The summary is the witnesses do some, touch here or there on Emmersfield, so if they accidentally read out a sentence on Emmersfield, you can disregard it. I've instructed them to try and
We'll try and remember not to ask questions.
So in that case, we'll move on. The first witness is Mr. McCrossy for the speed areas. I've got some summaries here.
Derby Asset Management, and I obviously hold some academic qualifications. However, probably more importantly, I've been involved professionally in the ski industry for 37 years in New Zealand and internationally. I held the position of a ski area manager at a remarkable ski area from 1994 to 2006, and managed Coronet Peak Ski Area from 2007 to 2012. Extensive experience with the New Zealand Mountain Safety Council, having a period on their executive board from 2007 to 2011. And I was a board member of Snow Sports New Zealand, a national sporting organisation, from 2012 to 2015. So that's my experience, and I will now talk on my evidence. The ski industry in Queenstown Lakes District makes a significant contribution to the financial and social well-being of the communities in the district. Contributes to a range of outdoor recreation activities available in the district, enhancing its reputation as a major national and international tourism destination. But in terms of well-being and the benefits for the community, I think we have to talk about providing the ability for everyone in this town or Wanaka or in the district to actually go into the mountains with easy access and partake in a physical activity, breathe in the fresh air, get the sun, and that has a significant effect on the well-being of our community and the people in it. So there is a major social benefit to the provision of the ski areas and allowing them to continue to develop. The continued viability of the district ski areas requires significant ongoing capital investment to continue to develop the offerings to remain attractive and competitive. Ski areas are a capital intensive business. And the recognition of the expansion of ski area activities and ski areas as a year-round attraction is very important in supporting the ongoing financial sustainability of the district's ski areas and the district's commerce. We talk about commerce. The local ski areas here probably account for about 550,000 ski visitor days per season, and between $70 and $80 million of revenue. And the latest report was done in terms of the economic impact by a group of the AUT, and it was for the summer ski areas, and that was in 2002. So it's old information, but that concluded that for every $1 spent on the mountain, $8 was spent in the community, in the towns, and up to $25 was spent per person nationally. So that 70 to 80 million becomes 500 to 600 million economy every year. So this is
significant. Just before we go on, I managed to get the 550,000 ski trips per year.
Ski visits, yes.
Ski visits.
Guys?
Ski visits, their visitor days.
Guys, yeah. And so
if you ski 5 days in a season, you are five visitor days.
Yeah. I missed the
financial.
The financial numbers that came after that.
Okay. 70 to 80 million dollars.
70 to 80 million.
On the mountain, which equates in 2002's economic impact study to around 550 to 600 million for the local economies every year. So it is significant. So we have, the ski areas have significant potential to develop and improve year-round recreation, hospitality and accommodation. A more integrated means of access passenger transport from the valley will improve the package of services offered, attractiveness and draw in greater numbers of visitors.
Mr. Crosby, sorry, just in relation to those, I guess as you just mentioned,
yes,
you said 2002?
Yes, that was a report done by the AUT, from the University of Technology.
So there's no more?
There's been nothing done yet. That was a report commissioned by the Ski Areas Association of New Zealand. They've done one for the Rural Paving District, they did one for Canterbury, and then finally they did one for the Southern Lakes. And that was to provide some information to the central government to recognise skiing as a major tourism contributor. Would be advantageous if the PDP recognised the intrinsic relationship between the access and operation of ski areas activities, and the advantages to be gained with improved efficiencies in access. The nature of locations of access routes is important, and the creation of access corridors through either the extension of the ski area subzones or through rule changes would be of great benefit. That way, development of land-based and passenger lift or other systems and the provision of infrastructure and services can be done comprehensively and efficiently, helping to optimise the management and development of the district's ski areas in the future. This also aligns with and supports the development plans for Triple Crown and Soho. it is appropriate to specifically provide for access roads in the PDP as the use of vehicle access is an accepted method of access. It is the only method currently used in ski area subzones. Passenger lift systems also need to be provided for to facilitate development of other transport options such as gondola and funicular type systems, which provide easier, safer, high capacity access. We mentioned Commissioner, that you mentioned the road up to Soho Basin, and that is still under construction. So what you see is not what the end result will be.
I'm pleased to hear that.
The submissions of Treble Cone and Soho Basin seek additions to the definitions of ski area activities. These are designed to expand the range of activities deemed appropriate within these areas and to clarify the status of activities which already exist. Under each of the activities in my evidence, I have added my explanation as to why it is appropriate that the activity be classified as a ski area activity. Currently in the current district plan, ski area activities, the interpretation is inherently that it's ski, that it's snow, and we seek to provide the ability to clarify all of those snow activities so there's no doubt as to their appropriateness, and also to allow for expansion to some operations. More and more of the visiting ski area guests have experienced overseas winter sports destinations. As I know, Councillor Newton, you have had extensive travel in Europe.
Commissioner. I realise it's an elevated.
But more and more of our guests have experienced overseas winter sports destinations where ski and ski out accommodation is a large part of the overall experience. Demand is growing for on-snow accommodation in New Zealand. The attraction of the guests is a much improved winter alpine experience, providing easy access to and from the snow. The character and ambience of the experience is akin to a Northern Hemisphere winter mountain experience. The concept of staff and other workers staying on the mountain provides many benefits to ski areas. Ski areas in the winter are 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation, including snow grooming, snow making, spill management, and logistics management. Provision of accommodation will provide efficiencies and operational safety via less fatigue and transport issues on the roads. It also provides benefits to staff by providing affordable accommodation, which is a major topic of discussion in the district right now. Just in terms of, we talked about Commissioner Sinclair, the 6-month pattern of use for accommodation. Typically on a ski area, in the winter, the main operational period is June to October, and that is when the accommodation would be required. And typically in the summer, the operation, because there is a quiet period, there's a downtime. So December to March or April is usually the summer operating months. So that's where there's a gap between winter and summer, so there is a defined period where there would be no one staying on the mountain. The concept of visitor accommodation is a growing trend in New Zealand ski areas, with the Department of Conservation approving a major accommodation development at Porter Heights Ski Area in Canterbury, and the Cardrona Alpine Resort operating its 15 units at or near capacity through most of the winter. And this year into summer, there's summer operations, and it was full. Cumulative benefits will be realised through guests staying on the mountain, using existing food and beverage outlets, improving the financial sustainability of the area. What we're talking about is utilisation of existing resources like restaurants and stuff in the evenings, not just during the day. It makes sense that any accommodation for staff, workers and visitors maximises ski and ski out capability. And use of the above snow line would be difficult to quantify, as this depends on winter weather, freezing levels and importantly aspects some of the aspects hold snow to lower elevations than all the aspects through winter. So a suitable elevation above which ski area accommodation would be suitable should therefore be adopted. And we have submitted 1,100 metres. The basis of that is that Coronet Peak and Truman's Cone base areas are around 1,200 metres. The other mountains are a little bit higher. However, we do have to consider the infrastructural capabilities of these and the likes of wastewater management, dispersal fields below that elevation. So those sort of infrastructures would need to be provided for. So we've submitted 1,100 metres as being appropriate elevation. So in summary, my evidence really with the PDP should allow for or enable the creation of access corridors to the local roading network, include the list of activities in my evidence for exterior activities, and staff and visitor accommodation should be provided for the ski area subsites. So that is my...
I just want to add perhaps to your paragraph 8 when you talked about the Department of Conservation approving the accommodation of Porter's ski area. I was one of the members of the hearing panel that granted the zone change that allowed that to occur, so I'm very familiar with that one.
Yeah.
So we look at
There was some discussion also on indigenous vegetation, and I can just probably explain how that works in both a DOC and a LIMS administered area. My experience with the DOC and recreation reserves and DOC administered Crown land is from remarkables and Coronet Peak over many years, and also involvement with Triple Cone. And my knowledge and experience of working with LIMS comes from the Soho ski area, which is within part of the Kadrona ski area subzone. There's different land tenures, however, with the Department of Conservation, they provide a concession for operating on their land. Within that concession is a requirement for a management plan and development plan to be developed and presented, and that's updated every 5 years. And that provides, from there, they provide an approval in principle to the development plan. Then each summer, the development plans need to be, the detailed plans for each project need to be presented, submitted. And that requires, a methodology and a plan for the rehabilitation and revegetation. And we have developed with the Department of Conservation pretty stringent revegetation protocols. And then, of course, there's monitoring. So there's ongoing monitoring with those. That's one of the areas where there is a crossover, and we have had discussions with council in the past that if we had having a monitor come in and do a monitoring report rather than paying a monitor to monitor for the council and then a monitor to monitor for the Department of Conservation, then it's more appropriate if that one single monitor may provide a report to both. As far as LINs go, Commissioner of Crown Lands, on leasehold land, we have a recreation permit at Soho Basin. Areas and LINs typically have probably historically dealt with farming, tenure, fencing, boundaries, all that sort of stuff. Ski areas is relatively new to them, so it's been an interesting process. But they have engaged OPIS to make sure that we meet the requirements of the Land Act. OPIS, in turn, without that expertise, have engaged the Department of Conservation. Provide us with the necessary, advice and what have you. Now, I think that's great because I have a long history of working with the department, particularly the local guys here who are very good. very practical, and those are, you know, we have development plans, we have, I guess, management plans for each project. We have methodologies, and we have revegetation profiles, which again, I said, they apply to the remarkables, triple cone, chronic peat. And you know, they are quite stringent, and we know that they're proven and successful in the alpine areas. So in terms of the deciduous vegetation, we manage that fairly well. In terms of, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
The management plans, what's the process for the approval of the management plans?
Management plans, we develop them and we submit them to LIMS. We then have OPIS and the Department of Conservation review them.
Right, and then what happens?
Then we enact them.
What happens if you don't agree with what they want?
We go back and discuss it with them. But what we do practically is we meet on site and we talk through things.
What's the expansion of the systems? Is there trying to remember which areas you've been involved in, but are there particularly different management plans in terms of the summer activity versus the winter?
I've only probably talked for Coronet Peak, really, in terms of summer operations you're talking about summer operations like mountain biking and stuff like that.
And particularly the impact that that has versus the...
Yeah, obviously there's the construction of mountain biking tracks, but it's working with the department, a lot of that was to do with the revegetation protocols. So the tracks are quite confined, and water management, and that's always a big consideration for drainage, because we don't want all that good work being washed away. So. And I'm not sure, I can't speak for Cadrona, we have a summertime operation. So.
Do you know of any
assessments
that have been carried out and ecological assessments that impact the scheme on vegetation? Do you know of anything in terms of the assessment for impacts of mountain biking?
Not for mountain biking, no. There have been for skiing and snowboarding,
yeah.
No, I don't know.
But not for summer operation?
That I know of. They're usually done by university graduates looking for thesis topics and stuff, so.
Make a call out.
Yeah.
Just regarding this work, the accommodation for visitors and workers, when you said there's a gap, if you're expanding, if the fields are expanding into more summer operation and that's going to go longer, will the situation arise, do you think, where there'll be people potentially there all the time?
I don't have a crystal ball, sorry, but I personally don't see it. I think summertime particularly access is a lot easier to the mountain. And I think both Queenstown and Wanaka lend themselves to living in the town in the summer also.
But perhaps is it that in those shoulder periods that the activities available on the mountains are potentially constrained by the weather and the circumstances?
Weather circumstances, number of people, I mean they are shoulder seasons, and also there needs to be downtime to actually carry out maintenance of the lifts.
Right.
In 5.8 of your 5.8C of your evidence, you refer to small-scale lodge and medium-scale lodges. Can you provide more detail about what you mean by small and medium scale?
Yeah, small scale, we're talking probably small accommodation units and clusters in areas that are visually unobtrusive. And medium scale is probably more an aggregation of accommodation around base areas. You might have car parks and base buildings and restaurants and things like that.
By more detail, I meant more about how many people per lodge, what floor area are we talking about, that kind of thing.
No.
What are the existing ones that Cadrona, where?
Well, typically Cadrona is, what I know of, you're talking about the whole lodge or the base lodge or just the accommodation units?
So I don't know.
Yeah, the accommodation units are integrated into their base building. And they're probably 60 square metres each. Maybe 80 square metres for a two bedroom. That would be my estimate.
Yep. And how many people are kind of residing in the medium sized one over the period you're talking?
They have 15 units, some of them are 4 bed, some of them are 2 bed, some of them are 3 bed, so
right.
That's the sort of thing we're talking, you know, maybe, you know, 100 square metres, 200 square metres, or 150 square metres, or, depending on where they are, maybe a two-storey type scenario where there's provision for families, or two couples, or plus single head accommodation.
In 5.4, where you talk about the passenger lift systems, firstly, my assumption is that all of the fields would need a road. Is that a fair assumption? All ski field subzones need a road?
Yes.
So they don't need one of those?
They all have existing roads.
Roads, yeah. Okay. And then when you're talking about the are there any plans that anyone has to, I'm trying to understand, where are they going from and to? So within this part of the environment evidence where it talks about within a ski field that you might have one within a zone, but it's from where you come off, is it where you come off the main road?
Yes. Yeah.
From there,
that's
like to the, top.
So it's connecting with the main roading networks in the district.
So you have a large car park at the bottom?
Or the top.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I think from the road end.
Are you talking about lifts or are you talking about a road all the way
up? So, if you've got a road already, I'm talking about a lift. When you come off the road, you park your car and then get in the lift. Is that
yes.
The idea?
Yep.
Yep.
Can I just expand on that though, in terms of the idea of ski in, ski out, so just clarifying, is that the concept of ski touring, you're going to accommodation which is further away from the main area, or are you still...
No, we're talking about accommodation within the ski area, and it may not be around the base area necessarily.
Right.
So you would ski to your lodging in the evening. It would be serviced. You might have, you know, ability to cook your meals or whatever, or provide service and we provide transport to a restaurant, which is at the base, and take people back to lodges and stuff like that in the evening. Or people ski to their lodge, which is at the base, but then they come out of their lodge in the morning, put their skis on, and they can ski to the lift.
So that accommodation would be away from the clustered area of the main development. It's well beyond what you talk about as a dock hut, like the wobbly hut.
Yeah.
You're talking about fully.
We're talking about very tasteful, comfortable accommodation that you would expect to find at a high end.
so it would also need an additional road transport network to that cut as well.
Yes, that's correct, but within the ski area, there are trails, there are already tracks, tracks that service the lifts. So they would be in areas that are sympathetic with the environment and unobtrusive, but within easy access of that. And we're talking over some transport here with rooms with passenger cabins and stuff like that. Or what they have, four-wheel bikes, if you like. Well, not bikes, but they're like a golf cart with tracks on them. So they're used in general day-to-day operations this year anyway, so skidoos, those track vehicles, snowcats. So that's activities that will be considered to be.
They don't always require a track. You can go off track through with either perfectly built road specifically, however, for a summer operation.
Well, in summer operations you do.
Yeah.
But they exist already for the servicing of the lifts. So.
So you won't be proposing any new ones in addition?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. Just trying to figure out the expanse of the road, and the transport infrastructure within that zone that may be required to fulfill your vision of what you hope to
do. That's only part of it. There's also the terrain development and trail development as well. So it's a significant amount of work that goes on creating the ski area. And that's where the whole revegetation protocols and stuff come in. So.
And possibly where the offsetting discussions come in.
Offsetting?
Sorry, there was discussion about
offsetting
previously.
Yeah.
The management plan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And that's done in consultation with those who we would expect that we end up in consultation with the Department of Conservation. Particularly for Triple Cone, that's the case anyway.
Okay. Thanks,
Mr. Crossley. In terms of the areas that are covered by the submission, the Soho Basin and the Triple Cone area, what would be the approximate number of staff and visitor accommodation kind of units you might be expecting to be accommodated within those areas?
I
can't
answer that right now. We haven't gone into numbers in any great deal.
Okay. So what about numbers of staff that work in those two areas that you might want to accommodate on the mountain?
It would be up to 50
on this side.
Or maybe I can put you wrong, I won't answer. I can't tell you off the top of my head. So. I mean, some of these mountains have 500 staff.
But there's only a certain proportion.
A certain proportion, yes, that stay. I mean, you're talking snowmaking, you're talking grooming, you're talking road management, street management controls. So. And each mountain is different.
Yes. So this idea of providing for staff and visitor accommodation within those two areas would be traction. Do you imagine it would be similar to the other ski fields in the district?
Yes, I guess so, and that would depend on land tenure. So I think if the provisions there was in the district plan, then that opportunity would be for every ski area, so
anyways.
Okay,
thank you.
May not be a question to you, Mr. Crosby, but you're the first one that raised it. In paragraph 5.5, you've talked about use of snow groomers, snowmobiles, and four-wheel drive vehicles as part of the ski area activities.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, and perhaps either Ms. Baker Galloway or Mr. Fugas are probably the best ones to answer this. But is it necessary to provide for activities like vehicle movements under the RMA? They're not structures. They're not in themselves activities which would normally be covered by Section 9, in my understanding.
Is that a question around the use of the land or activity?
That is part of the overall use of it.
Yes.
While you're thinking and answering that, how does that relate to where you might have parking requirements or loading zones that are required? Does any of that sort of, those other rules that are quite common with plans, does that kind of fall into tripping any of this up at all?
Will be two possible answers, two components to that answer. Would be the provisions of the transportation chapter of the government plan provide a framework around certain classes of activities and their groupings, like activities which provide the typical sort of parking ratios that are divided between staff and visitors and cyclists and so on. And related to those would be certain requirements for numbers of car parking spaces for each activity. I haven't researched the provisions this part of this event this group, but I would expect that there would be, as part of that, either an identified group which that would fit into, or in the case of an activity which is not grouped, of course, there's the catch-all one, the government plan, and that would be consent. Having said that, of course, I don't think we've got a transportation plan I'm not sure where that might go to propose that. But the second part of the answer, I suppose, would be the activity itself. There's a class of activity which is necessary in itself to trigger a consent for a certain reason, and to take them through about the visitor accommodation activity. There's the ability through that discretion or control to be able to include that, such as access, car parking, as well as the other services and structures on the road space to address as part of the activity.
Perfect. So it does say use. It does say use.
So that perhaps a clearer for what you could assist us with in respect of Commissioner Sinclair's question is whether ski field operators build their car parks to comply with the provisions of the plan and build them to fit sufficient cars in there for the number of visitors they expect to want from the mountain, and those two won't necessarily be the same thing.
I agree.
My experience has always been the latter rather than the former.
Yes.
And the latter is larger than the former. Same as supermarkets.
Yes.
But logical ski area planning and I guess international norms for ski area planning provide the ability to balance terrain and lift capacities along with road capacities and car park capacities. Now, typically the New Zealand ski areas have developed along a bit of an ad hoc sort of basis, and that hasn't always been the case, but there's plans afoot in some areas to remedy those situations in terms of what can be expected in terms of numbers and what can come from carrying capacity to avoid those terrible experiences that you may have had.
Okay, well, be on the odd occasion when someone's forgotten to put any freezing or something.
But the car parks are full and you're parking down the road and all that sort of thing. So it's a matter of balancing to make sure that the experience that everyone gets, and that's what's, I guess, modern ski area development and planning is about.
Mr. Bruce, do you think that the parking standards should apply on the mountains?
I mean, I've always been the idea that you've got to provide for, you know, the minimal level that a threshold below which you can deal with those effects, so that would be an unacceptable effect if you go below that single level, which means the car park ratios, and you've got to put a place for that. As to what, you know, those ratios might be, how they might be cut to address the particular needs of the ski area, I guess we need to kind of wait and see, see what happens with the transportation chapter once it's those. But, you know, and that could be possibly the need for a submission on that. It may not be included in the notes of the review, I'm not sure.
There are limits on the number of people through some of the mechanism that you can have on the mountain at any one time. Is that the case?
It can be if we apply it as an operator. However, a lot of the time it becomes self-limited. People come and have a bad experience and don't come back.
But is there anything that's required, you know, I don't know, you're only supposed, might for health and safety reasons, that you're only supposed to have what the field's designed to be able to deal with. Just sort of many people where you don't have to stand in line for an hour, get on the lift or something.
There's nothing in the legislation that requires.
Thank you.
My final question. You talked about informal airports and noted that the, I think, three flights per week was rather limiting. The council officers have suggested two flights per day as a permitted activity. I'm wondering, given that emergency landings are exempt from that control, whether and that ski fields overall need some form of consent anyway, and I'd like you to have an identified area used for landings, whether that adjustment assists and whether it's a real issue in the area.
Well, I think there's a growing trend of people who like to take helicopters to ski areas. It's not grown hugely, but just anecdotally, the data I could get from helicopter companies, it's not entirely 100%, because some of them do, some of them don't. Some of them had anecdotal information, others had quite specific recorded information. But you know, in the last 10 years, the requirement for people flying, you know, they'll fly up with their family. Just into the day and not fly back to their accommodation or wherever. That is something that is starting to see more of. So facilitating that rather than restricting it would be most helpful.
Just in terms of, we'll take the SOHO one, because it's so new, it's still presumably being designed and developed. Would that design and development incorporate a specific area where helicopters could land and park and leave you? That could become part of your overall approval process.
What the ski areas generally do is they provide the facility for helicopters to land and leave it up to the helicopter. My experience leaving him, you know, unless there's a private helicopter flown by the person that owned it, who's come skiing, helicopters don't generally just get parked.
No, it's too expensive to park in the day. I understand that. What happens at TC at the moment? Do you know?
Triple cone?
Yes.
There is a there's an area in the car park that is set aside and over by the river shed. general issues where that involves land at present.
That's on that upper car park area.
Yeah, out to the east. But it's not specifically designed as a helipad. Mm-hmm. It's just quite suitable as a helipad. It's failing during the bank and all that area.
And how frequently is that used, excluding emergency?
It's not very frequent. But it is, you know, in talking with the helicopter companies over there, there is a, you know, they have seen an increase. It might be, you know, 1 week or 2 a month or some, you know, some weeks more, it just depends on the time of year. But remarkables kind of peak that their owner is seeing an increase in gradual increase over time. But, you know, as we get more affluent people coming to town, they tend to want to travel on those sort of ways.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Costa.
Right, the next witness is Mr. Tyler, Richard Tyler.
The next correction is in section 6.4
on page 8.
On page 8. It's a good line done. And I'm crossing out the minimum to an average, which is a.
So what that changes to read out that
So that should read by changing the rules to require an average size of 1 hectare.
I'm sorry, I'm lost for the paragraph.
So it's 6.4.
6.4.
That's page 8.
And you want to delete?
So the third line down in 6.4, I'd like to replace a minimum with an average. And the last correction is page 12. It's section 6.27. So at the end there, I say it's in the last four lines. Replace subdivision, as I said. And that subdivision is here, so replace subdivision with visitor accommodation. And then on the next line, I'll just strike out allowing private investment on separate land holdings, comma, while. So that statement will read, I disagree with this statement in that visitor accommodation in the ski area subzone would promote viability of ski areas by reducing transport costs of workers, fostering tourism, etc. And the last one, conclusion. It's chapter 7.3, and I'll strike out subdivision in a ski area subzone in combination with the first words of 7.3 and replace that with in the ski area subzone. So that will read 7.3 in the ski area subzone, subzone accommodation and mechanisms such as learning plans. That's
corrections.
Any questions on those?
Refuse some of the questions.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's precisely correct.
So with those corrections, you confirm your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
And when you express your opinion, you hold that opinion based on your experience and expertise?
Yes.
And you prepare a summary?
Yep.
Could you please read that out?
Sure. So,
just before you go there, Ms. Baker, Mr. Pilot, you work for Derby Partners?
I've done those.
Okay. Have you got authorisation from your employer to give evidence on their behalf?
Well,
yeah.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I mean, we Derby Partners act as consultants to the land industry.
Right, and Derby Partners are the ones with the submissions that you're giving evidence to?
No,
no, Derby Planning Limited Partnership is the submitter.
Right.
Different to
Derby
Partners.
Right. Oh, okay. Right, so they're not the same.
Correct.
Same. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah. So, our job is to provide the experts advice and the input on that about each other, even though it was better.
Thank you.
So my name is Richard Harlow. I hold the position of Landscape Architects and Design Manager with Derby Partners Limited, based in Wellington. My expertise includes landscape architecture, urban design and master planning. Derby Partners provides management and consultancy services to the NCS covers and the schools. The proposed district plan currently focuses heavily on farming and productive value, which does not necessarily reflect the rural living element that is predominant already in the district. From my experience in master planning, rural living developments can be undertaken in such a way that will continue to protect rural and rural living character. Land-based master planning can lead to many positive environmental benefits, which should be promoted in the proposed district plan through the objectives and policies. The submitted land includes areas which have the potential for a range of opportunities, including environmental restoration, ecological enhancements, tourism, recreation and living. Derby Partners has a long-standing history of delivering well-considered land-based projects from conception to delivery through a landscape planning methodology. This master planning approach depends on the proposed district plan not being overly restrictive towards development opportunities subject to appropriate environmental protections. Rural character. The character of the Waxhippie Basin is not necessarily restricted to farming. The area is developing over time with an overlay which includes human settlement pattern. In the rural lifestyle zone, allow an average density of one residential unit per hectare would allow efficiencies in design and optimisation of land use, while retaining the open space and rural landscape qualities that the zone intends to retain. So just to quickly add to that, I guess we have to consider that I'm focusing on a land sort of side, obviously, that's undeveloped. So there's a subtle difference in the way that rule would be applied. Land that they have already developed under that rule versus greenfield sites. More specifically for the Lakehead site, this will allow an increase in density than is currently in the district plan to an area that already anticipates residential use. The amount of open space that would be retained would still, in my opinion, allow a rural living character typifies by predominance of open space over the built form. The 1 hectare proposed density average would have a wide variety of potential lifestyle concepts to be developed based on the existing landform and patterns of vegetation. For example, this could include a small cluster of dwellings in appropriate locations with larger shared open space lots or a single lot with cheaper cover potentially. Or alternatively, there could be a variety of lifestyle sections of similar size with your own productive paddocks. This sort of flexibility allows a wide diversity of design opportunities than the current density rule would allow. Section 3, that is built, so we'll skip that one.
We'll just stripe it out.
Sorry?
Just stripe it out.
Stripe it out, yep. So section 4, scarier subzones. A detailed description of the sites within the scarier subzones and the activities undertaken in those areas is detailed in my evidence, paragraph 4.3. Sustainable use and development of these sites in the future depends on provisions in the proposed district plan, which are not overly restrictive and which are flexible enough to provide for well-considered master plan approaches. Visitor accommodation in the scarier subzone will foster a sustainable alternative to the existing transport and commuting model within the scariers. Promotion of both live work and live play scenarios without reliance on vehicle use can prove very attractive. On this basis, opportunity exists to enable visitor accommodation to support commercial and recreational activity within the scarier subzones. Proposed amendments to the visitor accommodation provisions and the ability to use planning mechanisms such as management plans for ecological and landscape protection will provide the opportunity for the scarier to diversify and expand offerings on sites while protecting the landscape and ecological values.
I'm just wondering if you could assist by identifying on the planning maps whether Lake Hayes Estate
is or Pocket,
the same thing.
Yeah,
I know, and you can mark it on the
corner.
Perhaps if you outline the
site. Yeah, sure.
The sexual one.
Yeah.
Map 46.
Okay.
So the area that just marked, Mr. Pye, that's the same as the area that you've marked as number 4 on the map.
I presume so. Can I just come over and...
That should be attached to
that's right.
In relation to the corrections that you made to your statement, multiple sort of crossing out of the word subdivision, was that a sort of flip of the pen, or were you originally contemplating the idea of subdivision in this area?
Yeah, my understanding was it was an error on my part, at the end of the day, a lot of these areas are probably going to subdivide anyway, because they're obviously in the Crown Land. When I was writing it, I was sort of anticipating that any sort of use that could enable that or assist that use to occur would assist, to foster that particular the residential or the visitor accommodation to enable, I suppose. So, but at the end of the day, that's, that's a different chapter. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And then just starting with your summary.
Yeah.
Just at 2.2, you went off piece for a second and just mentioned, I'm not quite sure that I got it right, but you're talking about average density in greenfield sites, or are you talking about that average density also applying to brownfield?
So I was specifically mentioning that sites in particular, like Hayes, haven't been developed.
Yes.
So applying the proposed 1 hectare average density to that site would have a different, slightly different outcome than you would expect if there was sites with a rural lifestyle zone that were being developed, because they would already have, I guess, section sizes of 1 to 2 hectares, maybe even larger. So the development of those sites would not be possible because they've already been subdivided and their sizes can't subdivide further. So I guess I was just trying to put it in context of how it might operate within the wider framework of the district plan.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've had similar submissions from landowners around the Hawthorne Triangle who suggested that there might be some situations in which you could go to an average of 1 hectare sites,
yeah,
but others where you could. So you're not excluding the possibility of existing subdivided areas.
That's right.
Okay, an average of it.
Okay. I mean, yeah.
Thank you. And then just turning to your main statement of evidence.
Yeah.
At paragraph 5.2. The final sentence there. If the productive potential of this land were optimised, then this may have an adverse effect on the region and limit the potential for other sustainable land uses.
Yeah.
I'm assuming when you say productive, you're talking about agricultural productivity as opposed to other forms of productivity.
That's correct, yeah. So what I was referring to there was, if you were to optimise the farming potential of the land, that can have adverse, or potentially, there's consequences on the land. I mean, I've seen it with the introduction of cattle grazing and these sort of things on land holdings whereby there has a whole lot of farm effects. So, and I think there's a bit of everyone has in their heads the picture of sheep wandering through highlands, it's a very low value use of land, and I think some landowners potentially might have, they could be looking at other alternatives to farming. So the question is, what is that, and what are the landscape effects of that? And I suppose that's what I'm learning to keep that from process.
Thank you. Yeah, 5.6. You mentioned Jack's point there, and saying previously zoned rural, will be one of the region's largest satellite towns with a range of housing types, recreation and employment opportunities. Could you just elaborate on the employment opportunities that it might see out of Jack's point?
There's house building, and that's the growth of the town. Then once the town is established, Jack's point is currently zoned for commercial and residential activities. That could include any sort of range of business types, hospitality, all sorts of industries. So I suppose in that respect, what we're looking at is a new town which has a range of social and economic benefits. And it also has a lot of environmental benefits as well, which are, that's probably one of the most important things about Jack's point is it's transformed from low-value productive land, semi-productive land, to a mixed-use tourism hub and also an ecological benefit.
Okay. Thank you. I'm just moving forward to paragraph 6.4 and 6.5.
Yep.
and there's a bit of a discussion there around the one hectare lot size.
Yep.
And you mentioned it's a recognised size whereby owners can hold livestock for personal use.
Yeah.
Is that,
I think it's probably there's probably a lot of debate on that topic, but I would expect that you could probably, I've heard from people who live in the country that you could have a limited number of stock on a small section of that size. There's probably a lot of give and take and how much room you take to your house and all those sorts of things. But I think we also need to recognise there's a potential way that you can do these projects, not have your own landholding as private for the paddock, or you can have a shared paddock with, a home sheep. So there's I suppose in that respect, one paddock or one chunk of land can be appropriated over several lots. But I think, in terms of, we have to think about what the minimum is and in the sense of somewhere around the 1 hectare mark, I would say, personally, is my personal view. Yeah.
Okay, but in terms of livestock for personal use, I'm assuming that's more along the lines of a few chickens or a pet sheep as well.
That's right, yeah. In terms of a real productive, that's right.
Okay, thank you.
I suppose at the end of the day, there's a question, would people do that? And the next question would be, it doesn't matter, because it's space that's green, and it's, whether it's got sheep on or not, it's got a use that's not reported.
Yeah. It seems to me that it's more about the area of space rather than how productive it is.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Just moving forward to 6.7, mm-hmm. There's a discussion around suggested changes to rules around the use of shifts.
Yeah.
And how we balance that up with light reflectance rules. Could you just take us through the suggested changes there? I'm sure they're I assume they're referring to the attachments to Mr. Ferguson's evidence.
Chris is probably going to elaborate on that, but my understanding is in essence we're saying, well, shifts is a raw material that's forced from the earth and the location, and even though it may have a, technically it might be lighter than the LIV permits, it's still, because it's an enduring quality material, it should just be part of the suite. It's a simple thing, you're not moving it around. I mean, it might come from a quarry, but it's something that's from the district. And whether or not it needs to be or not, it's appropriate.
So is there also an issue of likeliness there as to where it comes from?
I think
there's
possibly. I mean, it probably needs to look at some detail here.
Okay. We've heard some reluctance from the council officers in terms of using words like local because from within the district there could be stuff from
what is local, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. So this is a comment that's specific to shifts.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Just on that point, do you have any knowledge of where it's just presently used in the district that is generally quarried?
Yes, there is. There's quarries. There's a quarry in Gibson. There's a quarry in South Crown Range Road. There, I'm not sure if that's used for building, but it is certainly a quarry, isn't it? The Milbrook Quarry, which I understand Milbrook uses most of the shifts from. It's Jack's Point Quarry. I'm not sure if that's still in productive use, but it potentially has been used in the past at Jack's Point. And so Jack's Point, I guess, set up their own quarry and has built homes and retaining walls and road material from their own quarry. So I think Milbrook and Jack's Point are good examples of master plan projects which are source of inquiry and see if we just give it another own. Yeah. Which happens, and it should happen, we should promote it under the right circumstances.
Thank you. And then just further down on that same page, at 6.9, you've got a comment here about an urban design panel.
Oh, yeah.
I can understand how the use of that terminology in a rural context might not sit that well, but the idea of design guidelines or a sort of design review panel of some description, presumably you're not adverse to that.
No, I'm not against that at all. I think that's probably a good idea. I think the urban design is probably just not quite the correct term.
Yeah, so okay. It's more about the words than it is about the idea.
Potentially, yeah. I mean,
do you see any distinction between the rural residential zone, for example, in the Waikato Basin versus the rest of the district? For example, is there an average lot size of 1 hectare in the rural residential zone out at Makarora? Is that different to
rural lot size?
Rural lot size, sorry.
That's a tricky one. I'll ask one from Macquarie. I don't know about that. But I think the point of the question, I think it's probably down to landscape, really. But those zones, I believe, have been highlighted as the very purpose of a rural living opportunity which exists because of the landscape, because of the way the landscape is laid out and the character of the landscape. So yes, I think there is merit in applying it everywhere, but if we believe that those zones have been equally enabled.
Perhaps Mr. Tyler would assist you if Mr. Ferguson was to show you map 16.
Yep.
Of the planning maps, and then you would get some concept of the rural living zone and Metalora before you finish that answering that question. When someone's doing that, please. I'm happy for my. In fact, there's a set of maps on the best of the fire under those folks. Well, that was the intention of, I think, of Commissioner Coons' question.
I don't know, I've probably passed through there, that's on the way to the West Coast, so I've been living down here for 5 or 6 years, I've passed through there once, but in the last time I'd say 2 or 3 times at most, but in not looking at the landscape objectively, I suppose. Look, I'm just going to comment on that. From a philosophical point of view, and I think if you designate an area, and in terms of saying it's got a rural living opportunity, then I think making it 1 hectare average over 2 hectare average, what I'm trying to say is that there's probably not a lot of difference. There's already going to be houses, and we're anticipating a use that has an open space predominance. It's whether there's X amount of open space versus another X amount of open space. And so I think we have to foster and accommodate land resources where we can, and it's another consolidation of land use, which which is
One of the reasons for the question is that we've heard an argument put to us that a one hectare average creates a higher level of efficiency of land use.
Yeah.
So maybe in the Wakatipu Basin, close to Queenstown, efficiency of land use might be a good argument, but Makarora, if you've got large areas, I hazard a guess, as I might be snapped up quite as quickly as the Wakatipu Basin,
right.
is efficiency of land use really an argument for going for a one hectare average?
Looking at the lot sizes on this plan, it looks like a lot of new bits. So is this proposed to this site or is it existing?
It's in the PDP.
It's in the proposed, yes, that's not an existing guide.
I think it's in the offer. It's in the offer plan as well.
It is, yeah. Yes. So it hasn't been developed out so far. So it's likely to play like that even if it's longer here.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Yeah. I just have one question. When you're saying an average lot size, do you have in mind that there would be a minimum lot size?
No, and that was one of my strike throws, because that was probably a mathematical correction in my past. But I don't believe so, because I think holistically, if you look at a size of X hectare-ish, you might have a cluster of houses on your site, with the one hectare as well. You could have a cluster of the site, and then one large open space block of land, and that will allow you the one hectare average. That means that you're going to get a certain amount of open space, whether the houses are grouped together or spaced out. Often, from a landscape point of view, it can be appropriate for the houses to be clustered, and that's And actually, a philosophical point of view, that can be, could be the way that the district should be heading, but I'm saying, either case, there's going to be open space and there's going to be dwellings, but whether those together or separate. Does that make sense? That's a question, but
the answer is not.
I think that was the answer.
Yeah.
Although, can I follow on from that, just for clarification, in terms of that average, you're saying it's an average for a particular parcel of land. So it is...
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep.
So it's not saying across the district there's this much rural lifestyle.
No. So if you make an application, it'll be a land owner, potentially, or it could be a group land owner, that's that.
Okay.
But that application, is that correct? The registered application?
My understanding of the law is related to site.
Yes.
Site is on the tip. Normally this is a part of the puzzle.
That's
the other questions.
No, actually,
the only question I have, Tyler, is why one hectare?
Yeah, well, there's debate on that, and
you already said it's more efficient. There's a whole lot of other stuff.
It could be
sort of more efficient.
It could be 9,000 square metres, or it could be 1,100 square metres as well. But I think one hectare sounds. There has been examples of one hectare as an average in the districts, which there people can see and view, and it's an opinion that works, and. There's enough open space there to enable privacy between dwellings, views and outlook. So I suppose what we're doing is considering the effects of people living there, and Bill and I are in the countryside, and then the effects of people looking back into that neighbourhood, and that it looks like a rural lifestyle neighbourhood. And it seems there's a collective thought that's probably size. If you did the maths, you could probably do some cross analysis of lot sizes and setbacks and building sizes, which I haven't done, so I can't supply it here, but it's something that could be done to clarify that as well. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
When you say they're examples of the district, what are you referring to?
So potentially, well, yeah, that's, so where would we look at? So we've got a plan that planning map, planning map 26?
Yes.
Now, well, the area to the west of Lake Hayes is predominantly larger than that. There are clusters of lots that are smaller, and around 1 hectare. And also, the other planning map we could go to is, I think we'll make our way through this. Well, I suppose you've also got map 29, and that's just showing the seagrass. Now, that's 1 hectare, aren't they? There's on planning map 29, Lower Shotover Road, Main Road, there's clusters in there that are getting close to the hectare.
This is in the Hawthorn Triangle.
That's right.
Just taking the Hawthorn Triangle area, and I think you're right, I think they are roughly around the hectare.
Yeah.
Most of those.
Yeah.
Are you aware of the planning, the controls that were imposed on the consent for that, to, in terms of the layout of buildings and the landscaping, etc., that occurred? You're probably aware of the, of the legal decisions. Mr. Ferguson, but
yeah.
I'm
that's first hand experience is in the council session we were able to report for the report for something. And that's the base unit of the range of controls and measures and landscaping and boundary and ponds and design generally. I couldn't give you the detail.
Yeah.
It's all from here.
Well, yes. I suppose the reason for the question is, if that is a good example, and that requires some consenting provisions to ensure that that outcome ensued, should we be providing provisions in a plan similar to that rather than more bold and just saying a 1 hectare average with no more specific controls on how the development could occur?
Well, we have
from a landscape architect's point of view,
we do have some controls in terms of the built form. There is those the colour of the LRB.
Well, then, it's only the exterior colour basically. Up to 500 square metres it would be permitted.
The tricky one about knowing the context of how that sector project was carried out, but I think in terms of I'm just thinking, my role is to look at the opportunities, and I think the best way to do these things. So I guess in that sense, it essentially could be landscape requirements. But that's probably more of a planning matter. So whether they're required, But in terms of, I think the key thing is really about the density, and that's probably the key thing. The treatment of the landscape is often a fruition of people having lots of land and what they do with it. And whether or not the landscape plan or a landscape plan provides for that is another question, because I think people should do it anyway, out the countryside. So whether they do it the right way is questionable, but I mean, from driving around the Oxford Basin, I think a lot of people and a lot of properties are quite attractive. And the body's a character that is growing and developing in the basin, and it seems that, I suppose, it's a positive thing. It's in the right location. Yep.
Okay.
Can I just one more question from that quickly? We have had quite a lot of discussion about planting, and you do draw on the concept of the need for openness, and I think that would be one of the arguments for needing a broader landscape plan to ensure that as you go down to, if you were to reduce size down to 1 hectare, that those sorts of issues
don't
impact on openness, which they
could quite
dramatic,
although
hanging out while their trees
probably have to. Yeah, I think it's something that the open planners would do anyway, and so it's hard for me to comment on that because we used to do that, whether it's required or not. So I think what you're talking about is relation to other landowners and other landowners, and yes, I think essentially that could be a good idea, because it probably has more merit if you have a smaller section size, because there's more intensity and there's more opportunity for, you know, trees to be close to boundaries and all those things. So I think you're right, yeah.
So then that would be
possibly,
yeah.
I mean, the openness thing, I think, is also a landscape matter, which is, you know, you have to look at in its own right as well, you know.
In this policy.
Yeah.
And I've got one more question. Paragraph 6.22.
Yep.
Can be defeated. In that paragraph, you talk about the use of ecological management plans or similar mechanisms in the ski area subzones. Do you see that as an appropriate means of managing the effects on indigenous vegetation in those ski areas such as long term?
Yes.
In all circumstances.
That's a good question. I mean, I suppose the context of that statement there would be that it's more aligned with it's probably got more relevance to wind building projects. But then in terms of the long-term approach, I think that could be...
Well, as well as the building project, you've got the earthworks, etc.,
which
are quite significant. Right. So,
yeah.
But you see it as part of that as well?
Yeah, well, I think if you have to look at the way ski areas operate, it could be, essentially. Yeah. I mean, I think most ski areas was... and I can't speak on behalf of... I'd say that it would benefit ski areas in terms of, I mean, I've heard from Amish that, you know, there's positive benefits to all this stuff, because the long term gains can be in maintenance and not having any sort of waterway issues or, you know, drainage issues. It's something that you have to look at what the effects of the actual skiing are, or the ski activity, and if there is any ecological, side effects of that, because that's probably the long term effects rather than the effect of constructing the project.
Okay.
Because I guess if someone modifies land, you know, you've got a direct impact on the land, unless you're directly modifying it. A lot of the ski activities sort of happen over the top, or on the pre-existing areas that are designated for driveways or gravel surfaces or what have you. So the tussocks, you know, tussock lands are actually a lot of the ecological strains. As long as it's built properly, it should be self-sustained and maintained as such. Yeah. So, yeah. Is that a question?
I think so.
Right.
I'm not sure it does from that, but I can, or for other potential summer activities, that we, and there's
yeah.
a question before, we don't even know what kind of tourist activity is going to happen in the future of changing technologies.
Yeah. But well, as long as they require some land modification initially, then that management plan should cover. So I suppose what you're talking about is ongoing sort of pre-digital piece that just starts to encroach on areas that are untouched.
Whereas the scheme, not all scheme takes place on the green run, it takes place
yeah.
across the basin, as would possibly another sport that comes along or activity.
Yeah. I mean, how does the answer that one?
I think looking globally, mountain biking is certainly a summer activity that is growing, and use of all the units to create trips. Mountain walking is another one that you can utilise existing tracks or can just be across Tussock Land, Bellevue. That sort of thing about these specific tracks, but I think that having the ecological management plan that is all encompassing is something that we do anyway. And it includes the regulation, it includes the monitoring regime, and it includes ongoing remedial works or organic planting. If we need to pass up seeds, policies and plant seed and the umbrella nurseries, and we need them to be using thousands of tussocks up and back into the area where the seed came from, which over time helps. And that's part of our overall ecological management plan. So it doesn't just, you know, you do one for a project, but there is ongoing.
That's what I was trying to
understand.
Yeah.
Is there a requirement to keep, like, to keep track? You know, when you're going, walking in the bush and says, please keep to the track, is that the sort of thing that you're fighting?
Look, with mountain biking, I think you need to.
I don't always achieve that.
Yeah.
with walking, no. And I mean, even at the moment, it's sort of, people just wander everywhere at will. Not that, you know, take your own apples, for example, and people go hiking there, but there's no tracks. They walk up to White Saddle and they'll walk down White Creek, and there's, you know, it's a route rather than a track. So there's no defined place they have to walk. People walk the time over here, it wasn't for an area of interest over here.
I guess the difference is that's in a very large open space and it's a very confined area. So.
Yeah, although when you go walking up there, it's not that confined.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
You know, we're talking 500 to 600 feet here. And these areas are quite focused on. And I have had this debate with some top people about, you know, we should build the tracks so that we can walk on. And others are saying, no, we shouldn't. People wonder if we'll. I guess it comes down to intensity of use.
It comes back to the question I think that we had before about the number of people that you'd have on any given land, that there's currently no restrictions, so that could be.
Self-management.
Yeah,
and that comes back to, you know, terrain, usage, balance
scenarios. So. Well, the interesting thing about that is the public use of land that's leased or, but, you know, it's a private entity operating at another time of the year. So it's difficult to impose something like that unless you're running this operation.
It's a bit different than the 10 years you see. areas of municipal conservation and there's right access to cover. So, and there's no control over where they walk. The areas where there's a recreation permit or where the occupiers of a leasehold area, we have some control over requiring people to acknowledge the risk that they've been on to these areas, just like the farmer could build a fencing from gate up and stop people on their leasehold and stop people going there from a health safe point of view. And it's like when you go fishing, you usually go and ask the farmer if you can go across his land. That we may not own the land, but so there's different tenures. So Soto Basin, for example, would be something that we would manage in terms of numbers of people that go up here and so on, but we'll commission that for us.
Thank you. I'm going to do the lunch now. Before there's any more answers. And we will return it to.
Thank you.
Thanks.